Well, today we pause to celebrate the farms and farmers that enable we, the people of the United States, to remain free and independent. And what better way to celebrate, on radio at least, than with your stories of life on the farm? And so we ask, what is your story of life on the farm?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,110th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Ushuaia who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Jason?
It's my pleasure to be here.
Can you remember back to the farm in your family's history?
In a sense, I kind of can. Yeah.
Where was it?
It was actually more of an urban type setting, but nonetheless, we did have a few things growing. Specifically, I'm thinking of a fig tree.
Okay.
Right now.
A fig tree farm.
Yeah.
Okay. Also with us today, we have our new intern producer from the University of California, Sarah Bell Lynn. Sarah, what about you? Can you remember the farm in your family's future or past?
Only through stories, in a long, long, long time ago in a land far, far away, my grandfather owned a town in China, and in that town was a little garden and a little farm as well as a little lake. I wish I knew more about it, and I'll have to get back to you when I find out.
Okay, good. Well, folks, let's begin with Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Kind of makes sense, don't you think? No food, no building sandcastles. Simple as that. It follows then that we, the people of the United States, are a free and independent people because we grow enough food to feed ourselves and each other. Much of this ability was learned on the farm by previous generations and carried into the city by succeeding generations. How long this ability to feed ourselves can be maintained in a city is a question open to debate. We look with trepidation to those in Venezuela, who gave up their ability to grow their own food for their government's promise of free food, only to see their government run out of other people's money and out of food. To remain free and independent, we must maintain the ability to feed ourselves and each other. Lessons learned from the farm help us maintain that ability if we remember them. And so today we pause to celebrate independence with a challenge for you to tell your story of life on the farm. So pick up your phone and join us. We're at 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. And just like that, we have one of the best storytellers in the United States of America. His name, Joel Salatin. Joel, welcome.
Hi, Michael. Great to be on with you.
Always great to have you aboard, Joel. And of course, Joel is the proprietor of, among other things, Polyface Farm in the Shenandoah River Valley of Virginia, a paradise of a farm that I've had the opportunity to walk in amazement. And Joel, I think you must have about 17,493 stories about life on that farm.
Well, I probably do, but I wanted to boil them down into one. You know, I've been here a long time, farming for 50 years. I got my first chicks when I was 10 years old. They came in a little Sears Roebuck, a box from Sears and Roebuck, and we put them in the basement of the house under a little light bulb and a little cardboard box, and hence started my farming operation. And the thing that the lesson that I'd like to share for 50 years of farming is how dramatic the landscape can respond under what I call nurturing. You know, our hands, so much we hear today is the legacy of human, human pillaging and rape of the land, of the landscape, blah, blah, blah. And that is absolutely true. And I have seen in my life on the farm here, sometimes I interact with nature and really make things better, and sometimes we make mistakes and make things worse. And fortunately, we've been able to, over time, learn from those mistakes and make things unbelievably better. Like, you know, organic matter moved from 1% to 8%. I mean, that's a huge jump in organic matter. The fertility, when I was a kid, I remember, you know, just there was no vegetation. It was just rocks and gullies, and now we have ponds and grass and earthworms and all that. And so the lesson for me is how gratifying and how wonderful it is to touch a piece of land in a respectful, honoring caress and tease out of it far more abundance than it would in a its static state. I mean, today we have fires everywhere, you know, from abandoned lands where there's biomass buildup. We have erosion. We have broken over dead biomass that hasn't been pruned by herbivores or by hand. And so I would just like people to think about the beauty and the abundance that can be created with a respectful, honoring massage of the landscape, as opposed to thinking the only way we can interact with the landscape responsibly is to, you know, lock it up in a wilderness area, a park, you know, some sort of a trustee's piece of land. I absolutely get the burden of the damage that humankind has caused. That, unfortunately, is a narrative of history, but it definitely doesn't have to be. And I can attest to the verdant, luxuriant response of land that is nurtured, cared for, and caressed over time.
Well, you know, Joel, I had the opportunity to see exactly what you're talking about when I visited Polyface, because you took me out for a walk. It was a light rain falling. We walked out into the pasture and walked up to your fence line. He said, "Do you see the difference?" And I said, what is he talking about? So I looked at the grass, at your neighbor's grass. It was gray, and it was laying down flat in the light rain, as if almost despondent. And then the grass on your side of the fence was blue-green and standing up and proud and happy. And the animals that were feeding on it were likewise proud and happy. And I guess right there on that fence line, it's a story I often use to describe what can be done with land. And there are a lot of people like you who are doing this with land. Not a lot, but more and more and more.
Yeah.
So the question is, those of us who have been raised in the city and for many generations, are we going to forget what's possible with land? And how can we help people like you keep going?
Well, that's a great question. And the automatic answer, are we going to forget, is, well, we tend to forget, don't we? I mean, out of sight, out of mind. If it's not pressing, it's not, you know, it's not in our face, we don't see it. And today, we live in such a frenetic lifestyle of impatience for everything that we do, I think, tend to forget that we are fundamentally connected to this ecological umbilical, this womb. And so what can we do? Well, we can put attention on it. We can actually go visit some farmers in our area. We can purchase at the farmer's market, join a CSA. We can actually, you know, develop relationships with the food treasures in our community, in our area. Fortunately, there are more of them today than there used to be.
You know, when I first got to your farm that day, that Saturday, there was a line of people waiting for something, and I got in the line. You know, being in the Navy, you see a line, you get in it. And I happened to notice that a lot of the license plates were from Washington, D.C., and I said, "Excuse me, ma'am, did you drive up from Washington, D.C. today?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, I take it you're here for one of the chickens. And she said, "No, not the chickens. I'm here for a salad chicken." And I thought, well, that's what we can do as city people.
Yeah.
More than anything else, that's what we can do, is that we can find people like you and support you. And in that exchange, we develop the kind of relationship that will hold our country together.
Yes, absolutely. And those dollars, we like to view ourselves as what we call the reverse economy. We are pulling money from the urban sector and establishing it in the rural. Our whole industrial food system is predicated on impoverishing the rural to the, you know, the wealth of the urban. And we want to reverse that flow. We don't want to impoverish the urban. We just need some of that urban in the rural. And that really keeps our little diners up, our little, you know, our infrastructure, you know, parts places, you know.
And everybody else. Joel Salatin, thank you so much for tuning in and giving us your story and bringing life to this radio program. Really appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. Who's next? 831-479-1080.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, What's Eating What is we're chewing on stories from farm life, giving thanks to those farms and those farmers that make it possible for us to be a free and independent people. And it's those lessons that we learned on the farm that we carry into the city and hope somehow that they'll survive generations of city living. And right now we have one of my co-workers here at the radio station, Rosemary Chalmers, and also have another one coming up soon. These are people I work with on a day-to-day basis, and like me, they came from a farming background, and so we share that often with each other. So I asked them for a story, and here's Rosemary Chalmers' story. Where is your farm, Rosemary?
Good morning, Michael. My farm was in the West Country of England in the county of Devon, which is a very rural county. It's a big county, and it's on the one side you've got, on the southern side, you've got the English Channel. And we were about probably 40 miles, 50 miles from the actual, from the channel, but close to rivers. And it was in the, we were in a hotel. My mother was in, owned a very nice hotel, and my father died, and it was decided with four children as a widow, she wanted to take us into the countryside and be, and learn more about the countryside. So she bought a farm. The farm still stands today, and when I went to see it last year, it's close to $5 million. It was a beautiful building. It was pink. It was a thatched farmhouse in the tradition of English farmhouses. Long, we had two, just over 250 acres. It was mixed dairy at the time. And actually, my very...
Does that mean chocolate milk and white milk?
Yeah, that's right. And one of my earliest memories was going to the equivalent of what we would call a county fair. And we milked our cows by hand. We had a lot of farm hands that would come for milking time. But we as children also milked. And mm-hmm. It was not automated. It was all done by hand. So we went to this agricultural show in Cornwall, the adjacent county. It's a very famous big show. And there I was allowed to choose my very first three-legged stool of my own. Because up until then, I would sit on other people's stools and use their stools. But I was allowed to select this very beautiful, not very high, stool, because they understood that kids were in the business of working on the farm, so they had stalls for all heights. And I will remember to the day I die, sitting on that stool the very first time. It was a summer morning, and it was very cool, and it was a sunny morning, and I remember just leaning in with my right shoulder into that nestling point in the cow, and feeling the warmth of the cow, and then pushing in a bit further, because I was small, and pulling that stool closer to the cow so I could get in and get my hands on the teats and starting to milk. The bucket was an aluminum bucket, or aluminium as we would say, and I remember that process, and I remember that specific milking process. And of course it turned around, and there's my mom watching me. So it was a rite of passage,
you know,
for me.
You know, when you said that, I could hear the splash of
yes.
the milk in the bucket.
And the sound it would make on the side of the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And you would slightly angle it so that it wouldn't splash you, but it wouldn't splash out of the bucket at the same time.
Wonderful story. That question, do you think you could teach our engineer Jason Struby how to milk a cow?
I could give it a shot. It's been a long time since I've done it, but I don't know. It's like a bicycle, I'm guessing, you know. I remember when we automated and we went to having the automatic milking machines and the cleaner dairy and the sound of that milking and the cows standing there in quite a contented position, you know, their udders just so full of when you would push against them, there was almost nothing to push until the milking was done. It was quite a pushback. But some very fond memories. I had three brothers. All of the farmhands were all male. So, and the closest kids were 3 miles away. So I had a very male-centric, not a patriarchal, but a male-centric time on the farm, which I think was really good for me. I think it was good that I had exposure to all of us doing hard work. And it was hard work. And when you told me that we were going to do this, I've sort of been thinking about it, and a lot of memories have come back. One, in the reality of it, after we moved from that farmhouse, which was a 16th century farmhouse, and it's still thatched. It's white now, but it's still thatched, and it's a gentleman farmer owns it and doesn't have quite the acreage that we had. But I remember once we moved from that farm, and we moved to more of a working farm, and not nearly as pretty either, I will say. And we were there, and we had, as most farms do, we had working dogs and we had pets, but most animals had their jobs.
Everybody on the farm has a job.
That's right. And I was walking in through the back porch where you put your Wellingtons and your raincoats, and seemingly it was a lot of rain in when I was a kid. And I was walking past one of the working dogs. And this was the farm. I think we had just over 700 acres. We had some of everything. We had chinchillas and silver pheasants. And it was very broad in its reach. Behind the house, immediately behind the house, was Penn Hill, where we would have the lambing in the spring, which was my favorite time of the year. And I walked past this dog. I was seven. And as I walked past the dog, I didn't see that the dog had a bone. The dog thought I was going to take the bone and bit me right by the eye. I still have the scar today. And I remember my stepfather whistling the dog immediately, taking the shotgun off the rack, going up to the top of Penn Hill, and boom, the dog was gone immediately. And it stayed with me because I was very sad at the time, but then it was explained to me, you can't have a dog that doesn't behave in the correct way on a farm, whether it's a threat to a person or the chickens or the cats or whatsoever. So that one stayed with me.
There's a lesson.
Yes, it was a big lesson. And then I think, finally, Michael, I would say that my favorite animals on the farm were the pigs. From a very young age, I used to like to go, and especially when the sow would have a big litter and we'd feed them with broken biscuits, and I used to like to go and get in there and hold the piglets and listen to the squealing. And I've owned a number of pigs myself in my life, had an affinity for them, and just in case you wondered, folks, they don't smell, and they're sharp and sharp as a tack.
There you go.
So there you go. There's a lesson
very
from
good.
A farm.
Thank
in
you for taking us to your farm, Rosemary Chalmers. Really appreciate it. Let's go to our engineer, Bill Graff, here at the radio station. Bill, well, are you there?
I am.
Good, good. Now, if as an engineer, you learned a lot growing up on a farm, did you not?
You know, I did. I it's amazing. I was thinking about it while Rosie was talking, and I think I developed my engineering skills on the farm as a kid. We lived when I grew up on a 99-acre farm in a town called Real Vista on the Sacramento Delta, and it's a farming community. And I remember one time my dad took me out because he grew a test plot of sugar beets for a test of a brand new machine. They were thinking about marketing. My hometown had a manufacturing plant, Black Boulder Manufacturing, and they, in conjunction with the University of California at Davis, developed a machine that would automatically dig sugar beets. And so they had this test plot of my one part of my dad's ranch, and we went out to watch the machine, you know, dig up beets. And the company that was going to buy the machine was there. And
how old were you at this time?
I was 5.
So you're a 5-year-old boy out with your dad watching this machine happen, right?
Right. And there's a whole bunch of people there, and they were all anticipating this machine, you know, dig the beets out. And it was pulled behind a John Deere tractor, and they kept trying to make it work, and it wouldn't work. Well, I was a little kid, in those days I've always worn glasses.
Bill, just a second. We just ran out of time. Can you hold over the break?
Sure.
So we can find out what happened to the machine that was going to dig the beets while this 5-year-old boy was standing there watching. Coming up next, we have Norma, who's going to talk about her farm, too, Connecticut Farm. And you, our phone number is 831-479-1080. Pick up your phone and join us.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. We are listening to stories of your life on the farm, and we're curious about what your life on the farm was like. With us right now, we have an engineer from our radio station, Bill Graff, with whom I work all the time. And Bill and I, coming from farm backgrounds, share a lot of that, that way of life that just will never leave us, I hope. So we often tell stories to each other about our experiences on the farm. And one story that Bill taught really captured my attention because it occurred when he was 5 years old. A young boy out in the field with his father watching some big guys work a big piece of equipment. Go ahead, Bill.
So here we are, we're standing in this field, and there's a lot of grumbling going on because the machine won't work. It had a toolbar that came down and was supposed to come down about 3 feet and then go into this soil and pull the plants up and dig the beets out of this field. And they couldn't get the toolbar to come down. So I've always worn glasses. I had my first eye operation when I was 14 months old, so I've been wearing glasses my whole life. So I'm standing there. I'm a 5-year-old kid standing next to my dad and next to Mr. Blackwelder, who owned Blackwelder Manufacturing. And, you know, I got these big Coke bottle glasses on, right? So I'm watching this thing at 5-year-old level. And these guys worked on this thing. It was maybe 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and they couldn't get it to work, and they were about to give up, and I finally grabbed Mr. Blackwelder's pants, and I, you know, shook his pants with my hand, and I said, "Mr. Blackwelder, I know what's wrong with it." And the head mechanic blew up. He just went nuts. He went, "You know, get that kid out of here." And Mr. Blackwelder looked at him and said, "You've been trying to fix it for almost 3 hours now. Let's listen to the little kid." So I said to him, I said, "Well, there's two hoses that come down. The hose on the far side is supposed to be the long one, and the hose over on my side is supposed to be the short one, but you've got them backwards, and when the toolbar comes down, the hose holds it, and it won't work." And the man, they all looked down there and went, "Holy smokes, the kid's right." So they switched the hydraulic hoses, started up the tractor, and the thing started digging beets. So Mr. Blackwell turns to me, and he says, "Hang on a minute, son." And he looks at my father. He says, "Can I borrow your kid for a while?" And my dad goes, "Yeah, sure, Ernie. Why? And he goes, "I'm going to take this kid to breakfast. He just made me a whole bunch of money."
There you go.
And I never forgot that. And, you know, my parents always let me take things apart when I was a kid and put them back together, and sometimes I didn't get them back together right, but I always, you know, had the experience of working on the farm with my dad and fixing tractors and changing oil and doing all that kind of stuff. And as it turns out now, I'm pretty mechanical. I can pretty much fix anything if I look at it long enough. And I think that comes from life on the farm.
And the lessons learned therein.
Yeah. And the other memory I remember is my dad, before dark, coming in and, you know, shaking my shoulder and saying, "Time to get up, son. We got to go feed the critters." And I think a lot of kids might grow up with a different experience now, and I don't know if that's necessarily good.
Wherein there's nobody shaking him on the shoulder and saying, "Wake up, son. It's
time
to go to work." Yeah.
That's right.
It's so true. You know, when you were talking about working on the farm, it's always something to do to challenge your intellect and your physical body.
Well, you know, my father said something to me that I've never forgotten. He said, you know, the animals don't have a choice. They can't feed themselves. We have to get up and feed them. You know, that's the way it is. If you have animals on the farm, you have to go take care of them. And, you know, we've always had dogs in my family. I'm training a new puppy as we speak. And I think that never leaves. Once you grow up on a farm and start that way, it never goes away, really.
Thank you, Bill Graff. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
All right. Very good. Very good. Now we're going to go to Norma. Norma Burns, thank you very much for tuning in. And Norma had a Connecticut farm?
This is North Carolina.
North
Carolina.
Say again your name, please.
Norma Burns.
Okay, hi, Norma. Thank you for calling in.
This is Bluebird Hill Farm.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I really like that name, Bluebird Hill Farm. Where was that?
It's in North Carolina, near Bennett. It's a small urban, rural area, mm-hmm. near, not far from Raleigh. And when my husband and I first bought the farm, we were sitting on the front porch, looking out over what was to be our garden. And a family of bluebirds fledged just at the moment that we were sitting there and just flew all around, just joyous flight. And we said, okay, that's the name of the farm. We had not yet named it at that point.
Kind of waited for it to name itself then.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I was calling because my husband died in 2005. And I have been taking care of this little farm by myself. I'm now 76, and I am ready to do something a little less physically strenuous. So I have a plan to give my farm away, because I'm aware that most of the farmers are in my age bracket, most of the existing farmers, 65 or thereabouts. And I'm also aware that many young people and young couples would give anything to have a farm and just can't afford to buy the land. So my thought is, I want to see this little farm carried on as a small family farm into perpetuity. I have an agricultural conservation easement just been placed on the farm, which means that my 13 acres cannot be broken up and turned into a housing development. It has to stay in use as a farm. So I am giving my house, my little greenhouse, my equipment shed, my distiller, my barn, and a lot of the furnishings that are in the house away. For the entry fee of $300 and an essay about why I want to own and operate Bluebird Hill Farm, and resumes for each of the couple, which the resumes are not the standard resume. They're the answer to four questions. And that information will tell me if that particular group, that particular couple, are the right match for this little farm.
Wow. So we're gonna give away a farm.
That's right.
Okay.
And all the information is available on it on a website.
Which is?
It's SABluebirdHillFarm.com. And then there is also a Facebook page where people are engaged on this subject, which is Bluebird Hill Farm NC.
There you go. We're going to give away a farm. Norma, I have your phone number. I'll call you up afterwards and have a conversation with you there. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, what is your farm story? 831-479-1080.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place off Guadalcanal, September 1942.
I heard Mr. Schaefer say there's a splash up forward, then the fireworks began. The Wasp was forward of us when three torpedoes hit her amidships starboard side. She started blazing and the smoke was pouring out of her up forward. The destroyer O'Brien intercepted a torpedo meant for the Wasp. We tried to take a torpedo as well, but it went right under our bow and hit the North Carolina. I ran after a life jacket and a tin hat. When I returned, the Wasp was down by the bow in a mass of flames. While the whole fleet was swinging around, we dropped two 600-pound depth charges on a contact. All this happened in about 15 minutes, and there was no unnecessary excitement on board at all. Everyone remained calm.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Ah, thank you, Will Strickland. So good to be back with you folks. We're talking about farms and farmers because they are what make our freedom and our independence possible. Michael Olson's first law of the food chain, agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Very simply put, no food, no building sandcastles. Easy as that. So it is that agriculture that provides the food and fiber that we need. And we learned so much when we were on the farm. And we took that that knowledge into the city when we moved into town. And then we've been living in town for generations now. So, you know, the question is, can we maintain that ability to grow our own food? And we wonder, you know, we look at a trepidation to what happened to the people of Venezuela who gave up that knowledge to a government that's promised they would have free food. And that government has run out of money and those people are in a terrible fix now and we don't want to be in that fix. So we think of our farms and we think of our farmers and we're holding them up today and that's what we're doing. And let's go to the phones and talk with Kelly. Kelly, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for calling.
Yes, of course. I was thinking, I haven't grown up on a farm, but I've worked on a lot of farms around the world.
Uh-huh.
And through this thing called WOOF, Willing Workers on Organic Farms. And that's allowed me to learn a lot about farming and travel. And it's been really neat.
which is really interesting, because if you think of farming, you think that you're kind of rooted in one place. But here's a way you can farm your way around the world. Do you have any good experiences, like I'm working on a kibbutz in Israel, for example?
Yes, I worked on a goat farm in Jerusalem, and it was in this really, like, rolling rocky hill area, and I would have to take the goats out, like 40 of them, for about 5 hours at a time, and, like, have the whole herd stay together. And sometimes it was kind of nerve-wracking.
Well, wait a minute. It's easy to keep sheep together, but how do you keep goats together?
Well, they told me to just, like, have a stick and yell, boy, 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 which means, like, here, here, come, or something. I don't remember what it means, but it was just, like, a key word that they would, like, at least hear. And then once I got a couple of them to follow me, then everyone would follow. But
okay.
First, they just wanted to eat everything around.
Yes, they do. They're the great denuders ones. I once took a goat home to my parents' house, and not thinking at all, I put it in the backyard, went in for a minute, and came out, and all my mother's roses were gone.
Yeah.
Something like that, right?
Yeah.
So, is that the first time you worked farm animals?
No, I had worked in Hawaii on a farm that had guinea pigs and sheep and something else, ducks.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What do animals teach you, Kelly?
To stay calm, I think.
The most,
especially the goats. Especially mm-hmm. the goats.
Because
if I felt anxious, then they wouldn't follow me.
Mm-hmm. Because if you get nervous, what happens?
Then I just can't get the goats to follow. I don't know.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for the call. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, you bet. Well, I guess we have a few minutes left, so I get to tell my story. And my story took place after I was spent two terms as a student body president of an inner city community college in Southern California. And it was particularly contentious times. Vietnam was going poorly, and students were up in arms. They weren't quite as virulent as they are today, as the anti-fa-fas are with their black costumes and their baseball bats. We weren't like that, but we were up to raise hell, and I was right there at the head of the pack raising hell, and to the extent that they hung me in the men's gym, but fortunately it was in effigy, and I survived. But at any rate, after two terms of that whooping it up, I woke up one day to the fact that I had not the slightest idea what all the ruckus was about and was in need of recalibration. So I went back to Montana, got a job working on a cattle and wheat ranch. First job they gave me was to clean the fermented barley out of the grain bin. So I spent all day cleaning fermented barley out of the grain bin, and when I got all the grain out of that bin, I felt pretty good. I actually did something. And I could see what I did, and I was kind of proud of it in a way, although it was a lowly task. I pulled out my harmonica, and inside that grain bin, I started playing my harmonica, and I was just having the time of my life wailing away on that harmonica, and all of a sudden, I had the sense of somebody was watching me, and I turned around, and the entire ranch family was there with their heads inside the grain bin looking at me in amazement, and from then on, I become their California hippie. And their very own hippie. So ranch work that summer was, as Billy mentioned earlier, all very physical and very mental. And wake up early in the morning, have a big breakfast. You go out into the field and you work. You repaired fence. You baled hay. You moved bulls from one pasture to the next. All very interesting. You went in and had a big lunch and went out in the afternoon, did the same thing. And in the evenings, I got the opportunity to, after dinner, is to go out into the pasture and get one of the horses and saddle it up and ride off into the prairie for those long, lingering Montana twilights. You could see 100 miles in every direction, and it was you and the horse in that stunning sunsets. And so one of those horses is the subject of my story, and I will tell it when we get back. So please do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're paying homage to our farmers and our farms for helping provide the food that we need to be free and independent people. Do stay tuned.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends, do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at metrofarm.com.
2x2. So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
So there I was working on a cattle and wheat ranch in Montana, recalibrating my mind after a couple of years of being a student politician at the height of the Vietnam War. Every evening I would go out into the pasture and saddle up a horse and ride off into the sunset, as it were. And there was one horse, though, in the pasture who would never come to the bucket of oats. And it happened to be the ranch's daughter's filly, attractive young filly that would prance about but would never come within yards of me. But at one time it came to pass that the ranch family was going to take a family vacation, and lo and behold, they left their whole ranch to me. Here, Michael Olson, take care of our ranch so we can go on vacation. I'm kind of honored that somebody would trust me with a ranch like that, and they did. And so my first thought was, well, I'll have a party. And so I invited a young lady from town out for a steak dinner and a horse ride. And so she came out, and while she was setting up the steak dinner, I walked out to the pasture to bring in a couple horses. And lo and behold, this filly came up, and she stuck her nose right in the oat bucket. And I thought, I'll be darned. And so I slid the rope halter over her and started walking her back to the corral to put a bridle on her. And she went along just as sweet as can be. And I thought, well, why walk when I can ride? So I slipped up on her back, and she was as pleasant and well-mannered as you could possibly imagine. And then I thought, well, why walk when I can run? So I nudged her a little bit with my heel, and off she went like a bolt of lightning. And I was riding like the wind, you know, just racing across the pasture, when I realized that I had no control at all over this filly. And she was heading straight for the pig pen. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? And as she got closer to the pig pen, I kind of figured out what she had in mind. So I grabbed a big hunk of her mane, and sure enough, right when she got to the pig pen fence, she put on the brakes and lowered her head, and there I went flying, pow, right into the pig pen fence. And so it transpired that steak dinner I was going to have ended up on my face instead of in my belly. When the ranch family finally came back, they took one look at me and said, "What happened to you?" And I said, I told them the truth. I said, "I just ran into a fence, that's all." But became very close with that family and through that summer, and was most appreciative of the work that they gave me. The good, honest work of getting up early in the morning and working hard, and the wonderful meals that we had together, and the conversations, and for allowing me to be their hippie. And it was kind of fun. At the end, I had enough money to buy a new pair of cowboy boots and a plane ticket back to California. And so always remember that. And always remember the good times I've had on all the farms that I worked on. And I want to give a big shout out to all of you people out there on farms who work those farms, who bring us the food we need to feed ourselves and each other, and thus make it possible to remain free and independent. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. I want to thank all of you for tuning in today. And what the heck? God bless America.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.